Okay, I'm Jeff Reckenbach. I'm here today with Velvet Hawthorne. Going to talk a little bit about her history with CWA. We're also joined by Debbie Goldman and our producer, Hannah Goldman, who's running all the technical aspects of this. And where are you at right now, Velvet? I'm in Cleveland, there in DC.
I'm in Asheville, North Carolina, in the mountains.
Okay, beautiful
Beautiful
Asheville.
here.
Yeah, very good. So, the way we've done these, we sort of we found it useful to get a little bit of the background of the individuals we're talking to, and it's kind of fun learning about that for us anyway. So a little selfish motivation there. But so why don't you tell us a little bit about your childhood and growing up and where you grew up and that sort of experience.
So I'm the second of four daughters, and I was born in New Hartford, New York, which is outside of Utica, Syracuse area. We say central New York, but it's really northern New York. And I went to elementary school, middle school, and high school in the same school, and I was pretty involved in my school's activities. In fact, in eighth grade, I ran for class president, but I was beat by one of the guys in my class. But I was still interested in staying involved and making changes, even in our school when I was young. I was definitely not shy. When I was in high school, they would call me down to the office when a new kid started school in the middle of the year, and they'd say, "Velvet's here to show you around." I was like the welcome wagon, you know. So I never had a problem making friends or meeting people, or you know. And I was friends with all the different groups of people in my high school. You know, we had the athletic and the music and the drama. So I was really kind of open-minded about everybody. I always accepted people. And you know, and you ever notice the kids in your school that were like the outcasts or the ones they picked on? I always tried to befriend them because I always hated, I'm an empath. I always hated the feeling they must have been feeling. And so I would reach out to them. So I was always, you know, very involved. And then when I went to, well, in high school, I was in ninth grade, and they were passing out these flyers. And I said, "What is this about?" And it was the youth hockey, ice hockey. And I always skated. My dad had an ice rink he put up in the backyard and froze it. And I said to my mother when I went home, I said, I want to play on the youth hockey. And she said, "Well, they don't have a girls team." I said, "I know, but I don't see why girls can't play." So she went and signed me up. And for 3 years, I played youth hockey for 3 years. I was the only girl. They did a story about me. And, you know, I had a nickname. My name was Henrietta Hipcheck. But it was an experience. My mother always said, "You can do whatever you believe in." My mom's always been very influential. And she was very strong-willed. She was the same way. She was always like doing things that most women probably wouldn't do, and she was very independent. And my dad was too. He taught us a lot. My mom worked a lot of different jobs, but her union job she was a school bus driver for a few years. She was a Teamster.
Very cool.
And so that was my first experience with unions. I'd never really, they didn't talk about unions growing up. They didn't really teach us about unions in school. But then I went to college, and I was in a 2-year college at SUNY, the SUNY system in Delhi, New York. I went to school to be a park ranger because my parents took us camping all the time, and I fell in love with the outdoors, and I wanted to do that for a living. But realistically, you don't make any money in that field, and there's very few jobs. You actually have to know someone to really get a job in that field. Like, someone's got to know somebody who says, "Oh, they have an opening." So I worked one summer after I graduated in a state park, and I wasn't making enough money. It was like minimum wage. So I supplemented that by waitressing. And that's what I did before college. When I was 13, I started working. I was working at a little arcade where I would serve soda and snacks to the kids after school. I always wanted to make my own money. My mother was like, "You can't get a new bike. You have a perfect bike. Earn your own money to buy a bike." So, you know, so th she instilled the value of a dollar in us and to be frugal. So that's where I get a lot of my, you know, influence from, was obviously my parents. And then, so I worked as a waitress until, let's see, I graduated college in 1981. And then in 85, a friend of mine, her sister worked at Empire Airlines in the call center, and she told me they were hiring. So I went and interviewed. You know, they said, "Oh, you can fly free. It's a great job," you know. So I went and interviewed, and they hired me because I had experience working with the public as a waitress, and they knew that they needed someone on the phone to take reservations that could interact with people in a positive way. And so I started working in this office. There were like 35 of us total that took reservations at Empire Airlines. We were a small airline. And 1 year into my job with them, Piedmont Airlines merged with us. And then Piedmont was an okay company. They gave us a little bit more money. I think we were making $6 an hour back then in the 80s. And then after that, US Airways merged with Piedmont and PSA at the same time. PSA was a West Coast carrier. And none of these airlines were union in the customer service industry. And I can say that when I worked in the Utica office and whenever there was some new policy change or something happened in the office, you'd be in the break room and everyone's complaining, complaining, complaining. And I'm like, I can sit here and complain, or I could go see the manager and see if there's anything I could do to affect change. So even well before I was involved in a union, I always wanted to try to make it a better place to work. Like I would always go in there and say, everybody's upset about this new policy. Is there anything we can do to change it? Maybe do this. And I'd go in there and make suggestions. So, and I never really thought about a union, but we had mechanics that were working in our building and they were IAM. And we would see them in the break room and they talked to us, hey, you guys interested in joining the union with us? And
Okay, let me stop
I
you
often,
there.
yes, yes.
Before we go too deep in the weeds on the union side, I want to get a little bit more about your background.
The union, yeah.
The growing up piece of it. So tell me a little bit more about some of the jobs your mother did. You said she had a number of jobs over the
Oh
years.
my gosh. Well,
And can
here's the
I
funny
ask
thing. My
one
mom,
key? I want
yes.
to ask one key question. I'm sorry to jump in. When were you born?
1961.
Thank you.
Yes. And my mom, when we were little, she worked in a grocery store as a cashier for a while. She would go to work when my dad would come home. And then she was a Tupperware lady for quite a while. She would go do Tupperware parties. And she worked her way up into a management job. She did that for a while. Then she decided she had this wild hair. She wanted to have an ice cream parlor. And there was an old pharmacy in our village. And he had an old-fashioned ice cream soda fountain in there, but he wasn't using it. He had just the pharmacy end of it. So he leased her that part of it, still had the pharmacy, and she ran the ice cream parlor. And so I worked there as a soda jerk for a while with her. And then she drove a school bus for the New Hartford school system for, I think, about 6 or 7 years. And then she decided to get a real estate license. So she went to school, got a real estate license, and she worked until she was 75 selling real estate.
Wow.
She's
Wow.
just a go-getter, I'm telling
Yeah.
you. And she's, yeah,
Yeah.
really
And
cool lady. She's 88, still drives, goes to church, goes to the
good
grocery
for
store,
her.
lives
Yeah.
alone. Yeah, still lives in New York State.
Yeah. And what did your father do for a living?
Well, my dad passed away last year, but he was, for many years, he worked construction, and then he worked in a Italian cheese company. My uncle and his brother, my uncle through marriage, owned Caruso Cheese Company in Utica, and they made all the Italian cheeses and the imports, and he would drive the refrigerated truck and go deliver the cheeses to all the different grocery stores. And then eventually they went out of business, and then my mom heard about this company called Fryhofer's Baking Company, which was like Entenmann's, right? They were based in Albany. And so she told him to go apply for this job. And it was a great choice for him because he ended up working his way up into management with Fryhofer's. He had a great pension and he worked there till he retired when he was around 60, 61, because he had some health problems. But he liked that job. I mean, but he worked crazy hours. And we got free bread and cake every day. He would bring home bread and Danish and all this stuff. And so yeah, so that was fun. And they always took us camping. We didn't have, we weren't wealthy, so I never flew on an airplane until I was like 19 or 20. But they would take us camping, and we did go to Florida one time and go to Disney, and we stayed in the campgrounds because we had a camper. So but he
And
was so handy. My father had a little workshop and he remodeled this old farmhouse we bought. And we would help him. We'd be out there with the hammers and, and he put up a basketball hoop and we played basketball. He had a boat, took us water skiing. We all learned how to water ski, including him. And it was just a, we had a great, I mean, growing up, we had a great childhood. We lived out in the country. And people don't think when I say New York, but we were, there was dairy country where I grew up. And we had snowmobiles. It was so much fun. We had a, I mean, really a fun childhood.
And you said
So, and
you're one of four kids?
one of four girls. So I'm
Four
number
girls?
two. Yeah.
Okay. That's what I was
And
going to
my
ask,
oldest
where you are in the
sister,
pecking order.
yes, my oldest sister was a special ed teacher. So she was always in the teachers unions in New York. And then she moved to California and was always involved in the teachers unions in California also.
Good for
So,
her.
yeah.
Okay, so let's skip ahead now to where you started to go with your union, or well, your airline involvement. Let's focus it on there. So I'm sorry, one more question. What position did you play at hockey?
I was a left wing forward.
Okay, all right, very good. Get that
And I
out
was
of
lefty too, because I'm
the
right-handed, but I
way. Yeah,
shot left. I
shot
don't know.
left. Very good. Okay,
And I still
so.
skate when I can, so.
Oh, good. Very good.
Yeah.
So you're working at Empire Airlines. They're taken over or merged with Piedmont. And does anything happen to your call center at that point when they
We
merged?
grew immensely. We had 35 reservation agents, and Piedmont hired a little over 300 people. So they brought in, they expanded the office. We were upstairs between two hangars where the mechanics did their work. So we were still in Utica. And Piedmont had a call center in Winston-Salem and Nashville. They had a couple of like locations with call centers. I can't remember exactly how many they had, but they had about four or five call centers.
So Piedmont is dramatically bigger than Empire at
Yeah.
this point. Okay.
Yes.
And they are now the dominant player in this merger.
Yes.
And tell me again, how long was it Piedmont before US Airways came along and merged? How long was it just
So
Piedmont that you were
it was
part of?
1 year with Empire Airlines. I started in 85, and then the very next year, Piedmont Airlines acquired us.
Okay.
And it was a hostile takeover because the CEO of the company at Empire did not want to sell, but the stockholders basically in the board of directors voted to, because they doubled their investment. It was $8 a share, and they bought us for $16 a share, if I remember correctly.
Wow.
So it was not, he was not happy about that at all. And, you know.
Yeah. And so
And then
now,
in that, was that,
no, go
sorry.
ahead. Go ahead. You, I
And
think
then
you were
in
going where
that,
I was headed anyway.
within probably 4 years, then US Airways, or US Air at the time is what they were known as, they had already been Mohawk Airlines. I mean, there were multiple mergers throughout the years. So then US Air came in and acquired Piedmont and PSA at the same time. It was a huge merger. It was the largest airline merger, I think, in history between the three airlines. And it was a huge undertaking. And they didn't do the best job because financially it was a struggle for them. They did bring us up to the US Air wages, which was a little bit of an increase for us. They had an 11-year pay scale for the non-represented people at US Air. So, you know, they recognized our seniority at Empire, which was, you know, which was good. And so they gave us our time with Empire and Piedmont. And we were making, I don't know, starting pay was around six something. And you topped out in your 11th year with US Air at $17.88 an hour. But once you hit that, we stagnated. There was no raises for years and years. I mean, like, so I went 5 years with the same rate of pay. But there were other things happening. You know, they froze in 1991. We had a pension. Piedmont froze it for the non-union folks. But they weren't able to do that to the pilots and flight attendants and mechanics who were already represented, and they had to negotiate that, and they weren't able to get that. But they froze our pension, and my current pension from that period, it comes from the PBGC, by the way. I don't know if you guys know about all that. But so then we had a call center in, by that point, we had 11 call centers across the country. There were 5,000 reservation agents. And the airport employees and customer service also were not represented. And there was a lot of talk because the airport employees worked side by side with they interacted with the pilots and flight attendants and the mechanics, and they were definitely more pro having a union than the call center people were, because they were exposed to it, and
Right.
we
So
necessarily were not.
for context, let's talk a little bit about that work. So the call center work for those that are our generation know, this is where you used to call in to make a reservation and or change a reservation. And all of that work
Right.
was done principally domestically at this point, I'm gathering. Did they have any overseas call centers, or all the work was in the
No,
11
we
centers
did.
you mentioned?
No, we did not at that time that I'm
Okay.
aware of. We did not have an overseas call center at that
Okay.
time.
And so what's that work like? Let's talk a little bit about that call center work.
It's very, like they monitor
Describe your
everything you.
day. Describe your
Yeah,
day
so
for us.
you would come in and you had to sign into your phone immediately, as soon as you came in. You had like a half hour to read, 15 minutes to a half hour to read any updates, any new information, anything that's changed. And then, you just plugged in, and I was what we called a general sales office. So we got just general domestic sales calls. And, you just answer the phone, and then you get 2 15-minute breaks and a half hour lunch. So your breaks were paid, you got a half hour unpaid lunch, and you better not stray from those 15 minutes or they'd write you up. I mean, like everything was timed, and you went to your break, you had to run, you couldn't leave the building, you had to stay in the building. And they were very strict about attendance. They secretly tape recorded your calls, and then they'd call you in and go over your call. You'd have to listen to it. I can remember they'd record me, and I would talk to a customer, and I'd say, they'd tell me what they want, and I'd say, "All righty, let me check that." And they told me I shouldn't say "all righty." They said, "You sound too folksy. We want more professional." And they were very strict about our clothing, even though no one really saw us. We couldn't wear. Here's the funny thing: they would send people home if they had on a pair of pants that had grommets on the pockets. They would send you home. They said, "If you don't look professional, you will not sound professional." That's what they told us. But we had to bid shifts. Everything was seniority. So if you didn't have good seniority, you never saw a weekend off. Which was funny because at Empire, it was fixed days off. But Piedmont, for a short time, we enjoyed what they called a rotating schedule. So you would have like 2 or 3 weekends off, and then you'd have to rotate in and have a weekend where you worked. We liked that. But when we merged with US Airways, they had a fixed schedule and they did not want to keep it. So they put a vote out for us to vote whether we wanted a fixed or a rotating schedule. And we were outnumbered, so we went to a fixed schedule. So I had for years, I had a 6 a.m. shift. In order to get a day shift, I had to get Tuesday and Wednesdays off. We did have some flexibility. They would let you trade days off with people to a degree, up to a certain amount. You could get someone to work up. They needed a Saturday for something, and they would trade with you, whatever.
And
So
was this a
it was
24
hard. I
hour?
mean, I worked holidays and I worked nights and, shift work.
So the
And
office was 24 hours?
it was,
Mm-hmm.
yes, 24
Okay.
hours.
And
And they gave us a little premium for working the night shift, just a little
are
bit.
you in like a cubicle, or is it just an open bullpen
Yes,
kind of a thing?
there were little cubicles, and you had a headset on.
Mm-hmm.
And a little mouthpiece that came across, and you would, and sometimes you could hardly hear these customers, or sometimes they'd come in and they're screaming at you, and you have to like, I think I have hearing loss from that job. I don't know.
And
But
so how did
yeah,
you know?
it was a long, tedious day,
How did you actually book them a flight?
So we
Did
used the
you have
Sabre
comp
system. Yeah, we
okay.
had a computer system. This was not too long prior to that, they just had a big thing up on the wall that I didn't work there then, but
Okay.
previous to having the computers, they'd have this big, like it looked like an airplane with seats. And when someone booked, they'd take a card and they'd go stick it in the for the seat on that particular plane on that day. That's how they kept track of it. But we did have a mainframe system. It wasn't a PC, and it was a Sabre. We leased it from the Sabre system, but we had like the low-end package. So it was interesting because we had to use these big, huge books, and they had like tissue paper thin pages, and it was called the OAG, the Official Airline Guide. So if someone wanted to fly on us to JFK and they were going to pick up British Airways to go to London, I had to pull this book out and look up what the minimum connecting time was. And I mean, these pages were, it was huge. It was every single airport in the world with all, with all the connections. London might have had 7 pages, and you had to look at the connecting times between which countries. So it was a tedious chore to do that. But they timed our calls. They timed how long we put people on hold. So if you put someone on hold to check something, they would tell you you're putting people on hold too long. So yeah, it was kind of a stressful type job. And
Sure.
they also would put up your sales reports, like, how many sales did you get? Like, did you ask for the sale? And right away, ask for their credit card. Ask for their credit card immediately. We'll hold this for you. You got 24 hours. And so it was, they stressed the length of your call was very important, how long you were on the call. And then they also stressed, did you get the sale? So
Did they have
it was.
standards for how long the call should be? Was there
Yes,
a
we had certain number. You had to reach a certain percentage, and you could get written up, put in a level if you're not performing at the level they want you at, or you get people that wanna talk to their customers and how are you today, that kind of thing. They want you to get right to it, ask for the sale, and get off the phone and take the next call. And if you go unavailable to get a sip of water, blow your nose, whatever, all that ticks, all of it ticks, and they watch all your stats. So yeah, those were sometimes very stressful to see.
Sure. So you mentioned you're in the sales office. What are the other disciplines within the call center universe at the airline industry?
So it was attendance, which was very strict. Like after 3 absences in a rolling calendar, you get put in a verbal warning, and then it's a rolling calendar. So, you could have 7 absences and lose your job. And if you're in probation, you can't be sick once and you can't be out in 6 months during probation. You'll lose your job. They'll let you go. So that was really strict.
So is there a separate office that handles like flight changes or that isn't just sales
No,
that's handling
we had a
problems?
desk that you did outcalls. This desk was what they called the reissued desk, or the, if we had a schedule change, which happened a lot every other month, they would change our schedules and we'd have people that were booked. So sometimes you would be put on what they called the queue desk. And what you would have to do is they would just pop queues up of reservations and you'd have to call that person and say, I'm sorry, your flight at 8 o'clock is now leaving at 11, or, we no longer have that nonstop flight now, or you're going to have to make a change of planes in LaGuardia or something. And so you had to be the deliverer of bad news usually, and people didn't always like to hear that. That's all automated now. You don't even have to talk to a person. They just send that stuff to you. But this was all during before the internet was really popular. So people didn't book their own reservations. And we did
Okay.
have one Spanish desk that we could transfer people to. But it wasn't in our office. It was like another location, like within the US, but it wasn't in our office.
Okay, so US Air takes over. They're now the dominant air carrier. I mean, they've got Piedmont, they've got PSA, they've got whatever others they've picked up over the years. What are they trying to do to consolidate all that work? Were there call centers that were being closed?
Oh,
But
yes, definitely.
Jeff,
Jeff, can I ask a few more questions about the work before we move on?
Sure.
Thank you. This is going to be a lightning round, a bunch of questions. Do you remember how long you were allowed to be, if on average, on a call? If I remember right, it was supposed to be under 3 minutes.
Did
Yeah.
you have to overlap? In other words, you'd be typing in information while you were taking the next call?
It wouldn't we That's why we would go unavailable, because we sometimes didn't want to keep the customer on the phone. So we would go unavailable to finish or complete the record, whatever it is we had to put notes in it, or and so that, that was always looked at. But yeah, a lot of times if you were, trying to finish up and then another call would drop in automatically, as soon as that person hung up, you got another call.
What kind of training did you have?
It's funny, they gave us 2 weeks of training. The worst part was learning the airport codes, because you had to memorize them. and there were a lot to learn. But 2 weeks of training, they put you on the Sabre system. And I remember having this little tiny notebook with like a flip chart with cheat tabs so that I could find all the entries, because the entries would be massively long to put in different, information. And so there were, and they never made sense. It was always some kind of, it was like computer language, obviously. And I'd never worked on a computer until this job. And yes, so you had a lot of entries you had to learn, a lot of them that you didn't use a lot, so you always kept a little book next to you to learn to keep up with them.
So it was very skilled. You had to learn a lot of information.
Yes, you did.
Did you have adherence? You had to adhere to your schedule, and if not, you were
Right.
dinged.
Adherence applied to your call times, adherence to your schedule. Yes, all of that, in between calls, how long were you available or not available to the customer? How many bathroom breaks you took? That was like annoying because, you're having a cup of coffee in the morning, and then you come in, you get your water, and you don't always go to the bathroom when you have your break. Sometimes you have to go, and they would talk to us. You have too many bathroom breaks. So then Piedmont came out and put a what we used to refer to as the pee-pee sheet. That's what we called it. And we had to put down what time we came, took ourselves off the phone, how long we were in the bathroom, and what time we came back. And we had to write that down and turn it in every single day.
And was there a
Yeah.
lot of turnover in the call center? Was there a lot of turnover?
Not really. No, not really.
And what kind of discipline would you get?
So our discipline was either on performance or attendance, basically, or if you did something egregious to someone else, or you got in an argument in the break room, they might write you up. But you only got 3 absences before you went into a warning. And we didn't have where it was, I got a flu and I was out for 3 days. That counted for 3 absences. I mean, it was difficult. You had to go to work. I mean, you almost felt like you had to go to work when you were sick, because once you hit your fourth absence, you got put in a level one. And then the second absence after the fourth one, so you get to the fifth one. If it's within the rolling calendar and none of them have fallen off, you go to level two. It's very quick, all the way to a level three. Doesn't take long.
And what's level
You could be
three?
out 7 days and lose your job in a year.
That's level three means you're.
Level three is you're right on the edge of being fired. And after you get another absence between, and we didn't have family leave, at that point. So there was no family leave in place until what, 90, I can't remember what year that started. 95, 96, I don't know. And it level three was, the one step before was your final warning. And that was it. And we did lose people to attendance, even if they had a serious illness.
And the last question, and thank you, Jeff, for letting me intervene here. You talked about before computers, which was before you started to work. And I'm trying to picture that people would get up and walk. And since you're doing planes far in advance, I'm not, how
I
many
don't think they
planes
booked
are
back then. I don't think they booked more than a month out, is what I believe happened. And yeah, so this room, and I was never in that, but I know they told me how it used to work. And you'd take the call, and you had these little cards, and you would put the name of the person and their phone number and all that. And then, you'd say, "Do you want a window or an aisle?" And then you'd walk over and you'd slide it into this little pocket, and it was representative of a seat on the airplane. And there were all these posts, these big boards with these airplanes on them, and it would say, every day of the week, through the month, like so February 1st through the 28th or whatever. Yeah.
So that you started, and then there was a computerized system. I assume you were networked into some kind of a switch that
It
connected
was a
you.
mainframe system, yes.
The
Yeah, there
mainframe.
wasn't a PC. It was not a PC. There was no, this was 1985. There was no personal computer, no mouse or anything. Everything was a mask. When you pulled it up, everything was already pre-populated. You just type in the information that
But
way.
you did have some kind of a
I'm trying to think of what the right word would be, but you were in front of a system that was connected to the mainframe, and the mainframe was in your building.
At the time that it was Empire, yes. But then as we merged and it went to these main massive headquarters where they maintained them.
And can you identify any other major technology changes?
Well, I think that like they improved our headphones. They got us better headphones so we could hear better. So those were better, but like no, nothing really that I can remember during the earlier years.
Once you had PCs, was there any change in what they were that employer was able to track and monitor?
Not much different, really. I'm trying to think. I can't think of anything that was really different. They pretty much stayed with the same type of, statistics that they used on us.
Did people think it was a good job?
People liked the benefits of the job, meaning you could travel. That's what most people liked about it. But people got very stressed out. It was a very stressful day when you're there knowing that they could be recording me, and listening to everything I say. So you have to be, really careful. You're always worried. And even when you were not on a call and you'd be talking to the person sitting next to you, maybe when there's a lull in the calls and you talk to them, they're listening to that too. They could listen to it. We used to sit there and try to put our finger over the little mouthpiece, so that I could say to them, "Hey, could you pick up a turkey sandwich for me or something?" Like so you couldn't, you didn't want them to hear you, or "Oh, I went out last night and we were dancing." You don't want them to hear any of that. You had to be really careful because they were listening.
Back to
Okay.
you, Jeff.
Yeah. So Debbie acts like I'm in charge here. Don't let her give you that impression. I am
He's
not in
retired,
charge.
Deb. He's
Yeah.
retired. He's not in charge.
Yeah. I'm not in charge of anything anymore. So do you still know your airport codes?
Most of them,
Yeah.
yes.
Okay.
And
All
I probably
right.
have learned a few more because of all the years that we've added more cities,
All right. All right. YYZ.
YYZ is, oh shoot. Now you got me.
Oh, okay.
That's not Canada. That's not a Canadian
Yeah, it
city.
is.
It is.
Yeah.
All right, so I know Montreal and Ottawa, YUL and YOW. YYZ, is that Toronto?
Yes, it is.
It is. Okay.
I deliberately picked
All
one that would
right.
be close to New York State
Try to
because I
trick
figured,
me.
yeah.
I thought
IAG?
Canada started with Y's for some reason.
IAG?
IG. Shoot.
It's another New
I don't
York
think.
one. All right, Niagara Falls. Okay, let's move
Oh,
on.
well, we never really flew in there. We flew to
Oh, okay,
Buffalo,
I didn't know.
BUF, but
Okay,
we never
okay.
flew to IAG, so I never learned that one.
Okay, all right, so let's get back to this. So I was just trying to explore a little bit about what happened when US Air takes over. Is there call center consolidation? What does that look like? And what impact does that have on the people in the call center you're in? And I guess ultimately their perspective on organizing and doing something about it. So, go ahead.
Well, so when US Airways and Piedmont or Empire and Piedmont merged with US Airways, at that point, we had a call center in Syracuse, New York, which was only 45 miles from Utica. And I always believed that there was eventually going to sh they're going to shut one of them down. And I kind of assumed it was going to be Utica. So before that even happened, I told my husband at the time, I said, "I'm going to look into other cities. I'm tired of the cold weather here and everything." So I explored all the airport, I mean, all the reservation center options. There was Pittsburgh and Orlando and Nashville, and San Diego was still open because that was a PSA call center. And I ended up putting in a transfer for Winston-Salem. And the reason I did that was because they had all these different specialty departments. Like they were one of the biggest call centers. They had the military desk, the human remains desk, they had the group desk, they had the rate desk. They had like each floor had different departments. And for me, I wanted something a little more challenging. I was like burnt out from just, I want to go to Florida. I want to go to Disney. That's what they call up and say, And I just needed something a little more challenging, and I wanted to move somewhere warmer. And so I convinced my husband, let's move. And so I put the transfer in, and it was a different environment down there. Being in the South, everyone thought they got a kick out of my accent. They said, "Oh, she talks fast. She's from New York, and here they are, all these Southern women, And I used to talk to a lot of the women down there and the people that worked in that office, because they would help me with a rate problem or something, and I would call and talk to them. And I can remember when I got down there, they're like, "You're Velvet. We've been talking to you for years." So Winston-Salem was a very big call center, and it was a smart move on my part. I moved there in 1990, put the transfer in. So I'd been working for the airline 5 years, and it was a voluntary move, so I had to move myself. And but it was a smart move, because not much longer after, maybe 6 to 8 months, they closed Utica, and they told all, there were over 350 people there. They said, "These are your choices. You can move voluntarily to Syracuse." And a lot of them commuted that 45-minute drive round, it was round trip, was an hour and a half. So a lot of them did that, but a whole bunch of them came to Winston-Salem. A lot of them did, like 60 or 70 of them came to Winston-Salem. And the funny thing about that is, with all the mergers and all the airport, the reservation centers closing, Winston-Salem was one of the only ones left. I mean, we had like three centers left, and that was it. We had Pittsburgh, and I think it was Winston-Salem and Orlando. And then eventually they closed Orlando. So then we were down to two call centers, Pittsburgh and Winston-Salem, when it was US Airways.
Wow.
But
So,
and we had reduced the amount of people, because a lot of people didn't want to move. And they, at that point, the internet was starting to become popular, so there wasn't really a need for so many people. I don't think they had started outsourcing to Mexico City yet, or to Manila at that point. I'm trying to remember when that happened.
Yeah. So where does the union come in on all this? You mentioned earlier that you sort of were not shy about speaking up
No, not at all.
and confronting management. When does
Right. Oh
the
yeah, I
notion
was even like that
of
in
doing this
Winston-Salem.
collectively
Yeah.
come?
Yeah. So in 1995, I got a phone call from Josie Esposito, and she was in the San Diego office, and she was PSA. They used to be Teamster in that office. And then when PSA was bought out, they lost their representation, because they didn't end up trying to have an election to organize all of us, which was
Wow.
would have been required. So Josie was definitely interested. She somehow got my name, because I'd gone to a couple of informational meetings, maybe at a Denny's with some other union groups, and I think maybe the Teamsters had come to talk to us. UFCW, United Food and Commercial Workers, came to talk to us. But we were in the South, and the women that I worked with, come in and say, "Oh, my husband said that I should not be part of a union." And I said, "Well, your husband doesn't put up with what we put up here. He should come and see what we do all day, But anyways, Josie got a hold of me. She said, "Are you interested?" I said, "Yes." She goes, "Can you see if there's more people interested?" So we started getting people interested. And then Rick Braswell started having these nighttime, like around 7 o'clock at night, he would have these nationwide conference calls. And we all started talking. He included the airport people, the reservation people. And you got to know everybody. Eventually we'd have 70 or 80 people on these calls.
Okay, just for a
And
second
the
there.
fact is, yes.
So the airport people, these are the people at the counter and also at the gate that, sort of coordinate your path through the airport to get on the plane. Is that who we're talking about?
These
Okay.
are the ticket counter, gate agents, the customer assistant reps that would drive the
Right.
handicap. And also the city ticket offices were included as well, which were located all over the big cities. We used to have those. We don't even have those anymore. And but the airport, we were considered by the National Mediation Board, which governs us under the Railway Labor Act. We were considered a class and craft. So anytime you interacted with a customer or a passenger, we were called the passenger service group, and that's how we were grouped together to organize and have an election. So
So
we had, yeah.
under NMB rules, the gate agents, the ticket counters, and the call centers are all considered to be one class of airline
One class,
workers.
and they called it a class and craft. Yes.
Okay, good. That was just for context, as
Now,
we'll go forward.
really funny. What's really interesting about that was when you go to a small airport. Let's use Greensboro, for example. Greensboro Airport's not a huge airport. They were doing not only just the ticket counter and the gates, but they would also go outside and load the bags. Okay. And when the IAM had organized the baggage handlers slightly before we organized, there was this weird, okay, we need a fence to figure out our seniority because people were told that you have to make a choice. You're either going to work inside the airport in a small airport like that, and you're going to just work ticket counter and gates, or you choose to work out on the ramp with the IAM. But they gave us like a cutoff date. We were able to achieve a fence agreement with the company before we even started organizing and working on our contract language to say, okay, I've got 10 years. I work the ticket counter, but if I go out to the ramp after they get their contract, I'm going to start at the bottom. So I want to keep my 10 years and I want to go work on the ramp. So there was this decision people had to make before we even started organizing. We developed this fence to protect our seniority. So vice versa, if a person out on the ramp wanted to come into customer service, they had to do it by a certain date. And then once that date hit, if you did a transfer, you were now in a different class and craft, and you would start a zero on your seniority for bidding and vacations and that type of thing. So that was really important to get that. And the company fought us about it, but then because they didn't want that division in the small airports, you know,
Sure.
they didn't want, they needed, because that meant they would have had to hire more people.
They wanted that
And they didn't want to
flexibility.
do that.
Yeah.
Right.
Okay, so let's talk the Braswell conference calls. Talk more about
They
those and
were, I
where they
mean,
led to.
they were very informative. We connected with people and were able to kind of network. And then at one point, you know, they were asking us to basically put our names out there. And he said, you know, we're going to make a list of people who want to be, I guess, interim shop stewards. And the companies, you know, at that time, if you had a grievance, they would let you bring a coworker in. So we became those people. We said, we put our name, they were on the bulletin boards. My name was up there. Management knew that I was out there talking to people about the union. And, you know, and I wasn't really afraid. I mean, I had a decent work record. I didn't think that they would come after me. And actually, I did get some pushback. And I had a threat one time, which was, you know, from one of the supervisors. She pulled me in this office and says, we found this reservation. And it was an international reservation. No, it was a domestic reservation because I had worked in international at that point. And they were trying to intimidate me. And I brought in one of my coworkers and I said, we sat there with our notepads and I said, I want to see this record and I want to know what you're accusing me of. I mean, so they were really trying to intimidate us. But after that, they just kind of backed off in Winston-Salem. And some of the other cities, Orlando was pretty bad. They really intimidated the people down there. But I stood up to them. I said, you know, I'm a good employee and that isn't mine. I want and they walked out of the room, said, sorry, we made a mistake. That's how that ended, you know. But it was scary. It was definitely scary. But I was very passionate about it. I was like, we need a union. We don't want to lose any more. They wanted to take pay cuts. Whenever they wanted to take a pay cut, they just took it. And the other groups, we knew the other groups had to negotiate that. The company had to do that. So that was part of it. And just having a voice at work to be able to just affect change in just our everyday job and what we did. So it was really important to me.
And
So,
why
yeah.
CWA?
You know, it's funny. We did talk to some of the other unions. We didn't see a correlation between us and the Food and Commercial Workers Union. And the IAM, they really weren't that gung-ho about organizing us. I remember one of the guys saying, oh, you know, they just don't want a bunch of women because we were a higher percentage of women in those jobs. And I did go to a couple meetings. They had a big cookout and they invited us to it. And they just weren't organized enough to really start something with us. And the first person that I actually worked with, and I got to remember her last name, she worked in the Charlotte local. Like, you remember Bonnie Overman? She worked with Bonnie Overman, and she was a telephone person. She worked out on the lines, and she came and met with us on a regular basis. Like, she was deployed to come in. She was in Charlotte. She would come to Winston-Salem and work with us. So she was like my first interaction with someone who was a union rep who was trying to help us. And Sam,
Was she a service rep?
she was I think she yeah she was a service rep. So she drove a truck and went out and did service. We didn't have many of the call center people come and talk to us. I don't know why. But anyway, so she was very influential. And then I'm trying to think who else came, but Rick was probably, the driving force. Everyone really respected Rick, and he was really good at what he did. The company even respected Rick. That they even said that to me. He was really good in meetings that we had with them. Very smart.
Who was
Good.
Josie Esposito?
Josie was a reservation agent in San Diego, and she was one of the people. So we had developed, Rick had developed a 50-person council, and we did elections. We actually did it democratically in our locations. If you wanted to run for one of the positions on this council, this bargaining council, we had elections within our own office. And so I was an alternate. I was not one of the, I was on the council, but I wasn't originally on the bargaining team. So Josie was, we had two reservation representatives and two airport people. And so Josie was one of the reservation people on the bargaining team. So we had, Rick had four people to begin with. And I was on the council. And then
This is once you already had the
once
union.
we already had yes, once we
So
already
I'm
voted in the
back
union.
to when you said Josie called you. Was she one
Yes.
of the early initiators? Is that why you
She
made that?
was, I, we credit her with the first person that made the phone call to CWA. We say that she was that person, yes. And if it wasn't for her, I probably would have never, if she hadn't called me, I don't know if I would have known about it when I did.
So the initial organizing came out of San Diego.
For the CWA, yes, for sure.
So just I want to do a couple of things for context. First off, you're going to have the opportunity to review and edit this at the end. If you want to call Bonnie Overman and get the name of that woman that came to all these meetings, it'd be nice to give her a little recognition. So, feel
Oh,
free to
yes,
do
for
that.
sure.
And
Definitely.
add that once we go forward. But you talked about the bargaining team or the bargaining, what did we call them? The
It
bargaining
was a bargaining
council?
committee of 50
Yeah.
people.
And
Yes.
so was this organized before you actually got recognition? Before you actually won your elections?
Well, if you remember, we had three
Right,
elections,
exactly.
and it
And
was a
that's
very
why I'm trying to put the
crazy
context on
process.
this.
Yeah.
Right.
It was after we had won our first election.
Okay.
Yes.
So let's talk about leading up to that first election, the one we lost, right? But I'd like you to talk a little bit about how that the rules are unusual,
They
and
are.
while we lost, we didn't really lose. So can you talk a little
No.
bit about that?
So if you worked at the phone company, your typical election process is you got, if you have 100 people that work at this particular location for a non-transportation industry, and 20 of them vote for the union, 10 vote against it, and the other 70 don't even cast a ballot, they have a union. Okay. That's different. That's the NLRB, right, that governs
Right.
that. But in the transportation industry, which is governed by the Railway Labor Act, it's all of the people in the entire country that do that job. So in our case, it was 8 or 9,000 people that were considered part of the class and craft. They mailed everyone a ballot that was eligible to vote, and you had so much time to fill it out and mail it back. And our first election happened right near Christmas, too, which was very difficult. People would get it thinking it's junk mail, throw it out. So anyways, we had 46%, but in the transportation industry, you get to get 50% plus one of those 8,000 people to cast a ballot. If you did not cast a ballot, they counted it as a no vote. So that to me was very unfair. If I didn't cast a ballot, I don't care. You know what I mean? Like, so I shouldn't have any say in this. And but that rule made it very difficult because we were spread out all over the country to get people to get the word out that you need to cast this ballot, you need to fill it out, it's going to come in the mail. So communication-wise with people to you know, if they hadn't sent us an email or you know, we didn't have any way to reach them. We had to go out there personally and go visit these locations, which I did a lot of that on my days off. I'd go to call centers and we'd stand outside and hand out flyers. We did that for almost a year.
So
And
does the
then
ballot that gets sent out by the it's the National Mediation Board,
National
right, that
Mediation
sends
Board
that.
sends that ballot out.
So are the ballots, again, just this is for some context here, do the ballots actually say yes for CWA or no for no union, or is it just yes
No,
CWA?
actually, it'll say CWA, and I think the IAM got themselves onto the
Okay,
ballot.
right.
And so you
Okay.
could pick the IAM, or you could do a write-in, you know. And I know a few people wrote in stupid stuff like Mickey Mouse or whatever,
Yeah.
you know, but they just didn't take it seriously.
But
So that's.
you didn't have to proactively vote no, because if you didn't send that ballot in, you were voting no.
Just threw it out, and then it was a
Okay.
no vote, right?
Okay. So we win that election,
No, we lost that. Well,
but for all intents and purposes, we lose by NMB rules. So
yes.
the overwhelming majority of people who voted for CWA.
Yeah, 46%, I think that
Yeah.
was. Yes.
So 46% of everybody that worked there,
Yes.
not 46% of all the ballots that were returned.
That's correct.
Okay. So we have to regroup now and try this again. What happens? How do we get a second election? Talk a little bit about that
Well,
process.
so you know, there's a set of rules that the company is not to basically intimidate us and hold closed door meetings to try to put the fear in us about unions. But we had definite proof. We had people write statements. Rick had gone out and talked to people, and we got people to write statements. And in some of our locations, it was very severe. People were threatened. And so we were able to prove to the NMB that the company violated the rules and intimidated us in many locations. And we asked for them to give us another expedited election and to tell the company that you know, you need to abide by these rules. And so eventually the NMB did agree to do that, but then the company challenged it. The company said, no, you know, you're violating our freedom of speech. And the NMB ruled against them. They appealed it. But while the appeal was going on, the NMB went ahead and sent out the ballots. And we won that election by, like, I don't know, 55% or something. It was 57%, if I remember right. I think I sent you guys
Yes, you
the
did.
timeline that I had put out for the steward training that I did. So we went ahead and voted in, started our process. And in 1997, we were working on getting our committee together, getting all of our proposals ready. And we actually, the company was required to start negotiating with us. So we're start, you know, we're negotiating, you know, we've got, I don't know how many articles completed, but we were a year and a half into it. Okay. And they won one of their many appeals on a technicality. So guess what happened? We basically, we're without a union at that point. The NMB said, oh, you know, some judge somewhere said, yeah, the company's right. So now, no union. So everything we had worked on basically was put on hold. And what was funny was, after that happened, the company put out a letter to all of the employees and said, well, many of the things that were already negotiated, we're going to go ahead and implement those. And we're going to give you this. And we're going to give you a raise in a couple months. They never signed it, technically. There was no guarantee. And they kept backing out of these promises, which was a benefit for us because it definitely convinced the ones that were on the fence, that, yeah, I think maybe we would have been better off with the union. And then we went to the NMB and we said, fine, we want another election. So we had to wait a year because in between elections, you have a 1 year whole, you know, 1 year wait before you can have another election. So during that time, we worked on getting the support we needed, letting people know these are the things we've already the company's agreed to. These are the benefits, the advantages we're going to get. That move by the company where they promised all this stuff and then showed people they really weren't going to stick to their promises helped us get one of the largest, I think it was the largest turnout. We had close to 84% of the
Wow.
members that voted yes in that election. So we went back into bargaining again. And
And just again, just so people understand this process that you're going through, because it is unique. I mean, it's different than a traditional organizing drive, a traditional organizing election. The NMB is the National Mediation Board that is appointed by the president. Is that right?
Yes, so you
Okay.
yes, you and there's three people that are in charge at that
Okay.
level.
And at this point, we're in the mid-90s, so the president is Bill Clinton at that
Yes.
time. Okay, so we've got a board that potentially is friendly and has said they did some unfair things, and so we're going to give you another election. That we run the second election, we win the second election. The company recognizes that they're not going to win anything at the NMB, so they go to the Federal Appeals Court to
Yes,
try
they
and get
did.
this stopped. And that's where the election actually gets overturned by the
That's
courts,
right.
not by the NMB. Okay, so
Right.
election three, huge win. People recognize now the stall tactics that the company's been deploying and acknowledge the need for having a voice to deal with what's going on in that industry, which is in some upheaval at that point as well.
Yes.
Okay, so talk about now you've won the third election, you're back into bargaining. How quickly do we get a contract then?
So I want to say it was another 8 or 9 months, and we were down to the three major issues, like every labor contract. It was pay, benefits, pension, 401k maybe. And we weren't getting anywhere with the company on those last three things. And it was down to that was it. We were going to be done with it at that point, and the company just wouldn't agree. Well, it's funny how politics played a huge role in this, and Bill Clinton did too. A lot of people don't know about this, but the company, Stephen Wolf was the CEO at the time of US Air, and they really wanted the London Heathrow route. They had a Gatwick route, but they could not get into Heathrow, and they really, really wanted it. Well, Morty Barr had someone get a hold of someone, maybe it was Bill Clinton, someone that, one of his aides, I don't know, and set up a meeting for Stephen Wolf to appeal to the president to try to help him get the British government to somehow give us a slot. One slot in London Heathrow is what we wanted. And if we could do this, they would agree to all these other things. And luckily, it happened. And luckily, that political activity that happened to get that London Heathrow route got us our last three items in the contract. And we got one of the best contracts in the industry. Honestly, I can say that. So it was
Okay.
an interesting lesson for me. I had no idea how much politics were involved in
Yeah.
what we were doing.
Very cool.
It's an education for me, for sure.
Yeah. So you've got a contract now, and you're still working in Winston-Salem?
I was working in Winston-Salem, and I got a message or a call from Rick Braswell, and he said, we're looking to bring in two staff that were on the bargaining team because to go back, there were four people, but after 3 months of bargaining, Rick realized he needed more people with more information from the small cities, from the specialty department. So that's how I got invited into bargaining. And I was brought in as a resource person. And then I was there through the whole thing. But Rick had decided, well, not Rick, but the executive board needed to have some people with airline experience in staff jobs to basically what I call is enforce the contract, police the contract, because we knew the contract, right? We knew every word of it pretty much. And we knew the intent and we knew what they, you know, we had bargaining notes. We knew what they said when we were bargaining. So he contacted me and said, this was in December of 1999, and said, I'd like to enter your name into as one of the people to consider in this position. And there were a few other people also, you know, probably four or five people. But in the end, I was a little skeptical. I said, well, do I have to move to Washington? I really, you know, my family's here. My husband had a business. My daughter was eight, you know. I'm like, I'm interested, but I really don't want to live in Washington, you know. Well, it worked out. So I ended up staying in this area and I worked out of the Greensboro office. He offered me this position. And the other person was Tim Yost. He was an airport person and I was a reservation person. So they wanted that balance so that we, you know, had that experience. But I also had to learn all the airport and for, you know, all the airport stuff, which I learned in bargaining. And I learned as I was traveling to bargaining all the time, I would go out of Greensboro a lot or Charlotte. And they knew who I was, and they were like, these are all the things we want you to change in the con, you know, we need these in the contract. So I learned the airport job pretty quickly and understood what their issues were. And so I think the same for Tim. He learned the reservation stuff as well because he had to deal with the Pittsburgh office where he was located. So we both went to training. We went to staff school, and 2 weeks of training, which for me was amazing. I was like, oh my gosh, you know, there's a lot to learn here. But you really learn. I had great mentors in my office. I had Jimmy Gurganis and Wallace Weaver, and they taught me way more than I even learned in staff school. I mean, they were great to have as my coworkers in my office. So they were wonderful. So I can say that, you know, without them, I don't know if I would have survived. But it was exciting job, very, very pulls you in a million different directions with all the things you have to do. But I kind of like that. You know, it was so much more exciting than the job I was doing. And I love to see the changes that we were able to affect. I mean, that to me was the huge reward, was just seeing, you know, the better pay and the better benefits and the holidays and more sick days that we got. We, you know, people just wouldn't comprehend the changes. They just didn't especially the new people coming in that didn't know what we went through to get that. So, you know, it was a matter of educating people about what we went through to get to be so they would appreciate having a union.
Sure. So describe a little bit of the day-to-day work that you did as a staff representative working with the airline units within
Yeah, well, in the
CWI.
beginning, our biggest chore was to get shop stewards. So without shop stewards, you know, managers could do whatever they wanted because people weren't aware of all the intricacies of the contract and the things that the managers are supposed to, you know, follow. And especially in the small cities, right? The little airports, Myrtle Beach, whatever, they were doing their own thing. And so we had to go to these locations and recruit people to become shop stewards. Then we had to train them. So we had a massive drive to get about 600 shop stewards across the country. And even that wasn't even enough, you know. So that was a chore, you know, and also teaching them how to write a grievance, all of that stuff, and how to interact with management. We even had to teach management. Like we'd go to these airports and say to management, look, I need to show you in the contract where you're doing this wrong, you know, and just kind of relate to them. But we also had to set up locals, which was a huge task because there was some question as to whether to merge us into existing like telephone locals or create our locals. So they did create, the executive board decided, you know, they were going to create airline locals. And so we had one in Charlotte, one in Pittsburgh, we had one in Philly, we had one in the New England states in Boston, Florida had a local. So we had seven locals altogether. And they covered large areas. I mean, like Charlotte had nine or seven states. Florida local covered the entire state of Florida. District one, which was based in Boston, they covered all the cities in the New England states in District one in one local. So it, you know, it if it could have been done differently, I don't know if it would have been better. Because you got brand new people now running for a local officer and they've never been in a union before. So that was a huge training, issue we had, and just training people how to do this. So we had one in DC as well. We had a well, Virginia. We had a local there. I think Pam, I forget her last name already, but she was our local president there.
Trouser?
What's
Wasn't
that?
Pam, it wasn't Pam Trouser, was it?
No.
Yeah. Okay.
Pam was she worked in the DC airport, and she was our
Okay.
local president there. She was very good too.
Yeah.
Yeah. So we had to start from fresh, brand new locals. So that was our first task. And
And you're
then
doing this,
just
and
getting
you've.
people to file agreement.
So you're doing
I'd
all
never
this,
done
and
any
you've
of that.
never been a local officer yourself. I mean,
Never.
you've come
I
right
never
off
served.
the call center in Winston-Salem, and now you've
Yeah.
done 2 weeks of training,
That's it.
and now all of a sudden you are going to train these people how to be a
Yeah.
steward, how to be a local officer,
Right.
all the rest
What
of
was
it.
nice was in the beginning, Jimmy Gerganis would come with me, and he would teach steward training with me the first couple times I did it, just to get me used to it. He was so funny. He was the best, and he was a great teacher. He really taught me a lot of. He always used to say, "You leave the dance with the one you came with." He always said that. Like, if you're a shop steward and you've got someone in there with you that you're representing, don't sit there and start agreeing with management. This is you need to be there for that person. And so that was always a fun saying, "You leave the dance with the one that brung you." That's what he would say.
Very cool. And
So
so what I
he was very instrumental in helping me learn how to do it.
Yeah. So what else do they have you doing then as a staff rep? You've sort of evolved then. You've at least got your
Right.
600 stewards. You've got some
Yes.
locals stand up. What now is the task that
Well, you
you
also have to get people to sign a dues card, right? So, and we had a closed shop. In the airline industry, you tend to have a closed shop. That's usually the norm. There's a
Okay,
lot of
describe
reasons
it.
for it.
Tell us what a closed shop is, just for
Okay.
kind.
So a closed shop means that you're either a dues-paying member, and you sign up to be a member of the local, or you can be what they call an agency fee payer, where you do not want to be a member for some reason, whether it's a religious reason or just your own personal reason you don't want to be in a union. You then become an agency fee payer, so you're still paying dues of some sort, and it's usually the same amount, but like some percentage of it can go to a charity of your choice if you'd like to donate some of that money. And then there are the religious objectors as well. So you have like three different categories. You're either a member, an agency fee payer, or a religious objector. But in non-transportation industries, you still, you don't have to sign a card. There's no agency fee issue. This is all having to do with the transportation issue. And I think mainly it came about because years ago, the railways, if they had a strike in New York, but California wasn't striking, or vice versa, you had a strike in California, and this train was being, sent with carloads of, rail cars full of stuff. When it got to California, they weren't going to unload it because they were on strike. So they all had to be working in concert. And I think that part of it also, like if you want to strike in the airline industry, you have a 60-day cooling off period, and it can be basically stopped by the president, which he did to the American Airlines pilots. I don't know if you remember that, but they tried to strike, and Clinton said, can't do it because of commerce. It interrupts commerce, is basically the main reason for that. So teaching people about the contract and how to understand it and find what you need in that contract to know what the rules are. That wasn't just about the steward training part. We would go to the airports and rent a big room, like a conference room, and have people come in and sit with us. And we would go over the major parts of the contract to teach people how to use your contract, how to find what you need, how to write a grievance. So that was all a huge undertaking for us as well.
You mentioned a little while ago, this was sort of an eye-opening experience for you in terms of political action.
Yes. And I
So can
enjoyed
you?
that a lot because I didn't realize how much we
Yeah.
got involved, and we did get involved with trying to get protections for our folks. When 9/11 happened, the flight attendants and pilots were able to get air rage law passed. And we had customers that had assaulted our agents. They missed their flight. They were drunk in the airport. We had one guy in New Jersey had his neck broken. So we tallied. Rick had us put together all the examples of the violence that people face from the general traveling public. And the John Kerry, Massachusetts, was the one who introduced the bill for us. And we lobbied very strongly to get that passed. And it was successful. But then we went to the company and we said, now that we have this law, we want you to post this on the podium so the customers know. They refused to do it. They would not post it. They said, oh, it's like assuming these people are all going to do something bad and we don't want to give them a bad taste in their mouths about it. So they would never post it. We even said, put it in, back when you used to get a ticket jacket and they put your ticket in it. We said, well, put the FAA warning here, that they could be in trouble if they assaulted or interrupted our duty as a, to secure the door, because people would try to run through the door. We'd shut the door of the aircraft and it's backing off and these people miss their flight and they'd start screaming and yelling and throwing computers and just terrible behavior. And I know you saw it during COVID too, it was worse. But that law, we had a hard time getting the company to enforce it. So we would have agents, especially Philadelphia, for some reason, we would hear stories of a customer losing it and trying to assault one of the agents, and a manager would walk over and go, oh, Mr. Jones, we're just going to put you in first class for your trouble. They were rewarding these people for bad behavior. So we took it a step further. And I used to go to these meetings every 2 months with the CEO and board of directors. It was a labor management meetings. And I got other groups to support us. And we said, we want a no-fly list. We want a company no-fly list. And it took us a while, but we convinced him. So anybody that assaulted one of our agents or did something, whether it was on an aircraft or whether it was, in the airport, they actually did create a no-fly list, and it worked. So they did listen to us. So that was very effective also.
So the bill you're talking about is commonly referred to as the Airport Rage Bill. Is that?
Airport rage bill, yes.
Okay. Very cool.
And it didn't just help us, it helped all of the airline workers, whether they were union or not. And see, that's what I used to tell people. We started to organize other airlines. We'd say, I don't know if you realize this, but this airport rage bill was brought about by the union, by us, because, and it protects you, whether you pay dues or not, you have this protection.
Right. You mentioned 9/11 just a few minutes ago.
Yes.
Talk about the impact that that had
Well,
on the call
obviously it
centers and
grounded.
the gate agents
Yeah.
and all those
Well,
workers.
it grounded aircraft, it grounded all airlines. And it basically caused a financial burden on most of the airlines because they weren't flying or people just weren't traveling as much, whether it was out of fear. But they had shut them pretty much. We reduced our schedules. So financially, it hurt. I know it hurt us because we ended up filing Chapter 11 shortly after that.
We as US Air.
And that was US Air and a couple other airlines. I think America West also did. And they wanted us to come to the table before they filed Chapter 11 and just start giving stuff up, like massively giving stuff up. And all the other unions went to the table except CWA. And we said, until you file Chapter 11, we're not giving you anything. We're the lowest paid in the industry of all of the groups that you have in this company. And we're not the problem here. We are not the problem. Your CEOs were getting bonuses at the time. They were laying people off and cutting our benefits or trying to, anyways. And we actually went to federal court. I don't know if you remember that, but I testified, Tim testified, a bunch of flight attendants did, because the judge was trying to decide, they were looking for it was like a $500 million concession, something around that amount. And we went and said, until the high level managers start taking some cuts and stop getting these raises, we're not willing to negotiate that. So the judge kind of split the baby. Instead of 500 million, he told them you can do 250 million. I can't remember the exact amount, but it helped a little, but it still was very damaging to a lot of people because the pay cuts we ended up, you know, we did negotiate what we wanted to give up once they filed Chapter 11. So that gave us a choice of what they took. And we decided, you know, what are we going to give them? We're going to give them 5 sick days. We're going to give them holidays. You don't want them, we didn't want them to touch our pay. You know, we said these things we can, and but the smartest thing that Rick came up with in during that time, we were the only union on the property that said, and by 2011, we want snapbacks. All this stuff that we gave up comes back automatically. We were the only union that did that. The other unions, once that, they had to go back in the next contract and try to get it all back. So we got everything, our sick days back, our holidays back. It was, oh, and the biggest thing was during that time, they wanted to outsource a percentage of our call centers. And we were fighting it, but eventually we said, okay, here's the deal. You can outsource, you're not going to lay off any of our folks, okay? All their jobs are guaranteed. You can outsource these call centers, meaning they wouldn't be hiring a lot of people for a while. And you have until October 2011 to bring this work back. We said it's guaranteed to come back to our, and it's going to be union work. It's coming back. It's got to end. And this is a funny story. So about 6 months before that date, Doug Parker came out and said, he's the CEO of the company at that time. He said, we're going to bring the work back because we just feel like we should bring the work back. And I think Obama was in office at the time, and he was encouraging companies to stop offshoring, bring the work back to the United States. And so, you know, they said, we're going to do that out of the bottom of our hearts. You know, we're just going to do this. Little did Obama know, or the, you know, political folks said, oh, that's just great, you know. And when I found out, I got a hold of Rick. Not was it Rick? Not at the time. Rick wasn't there. I might have called you, and I said, you know, they're inviting this guy to this luncheon at the White House to reward the company for bringing this work back to the United States. And I said, that's not the whole reason why they're doing it. And so we got a hold of somebody. Our legislative political department got a hold of somebody at the White House, and we got, I think it was Ron Collins, got invited to the luncheon, and they sat him right next to the guy at US Airways, and he let them know this was a negotiated job, you know, return jobs to the US with the union. It wasn't out of the goodness of the heart of the airline. So I thought that was a pretty interesting, and we let people know that too. We said this work is coming back because we had this in our contract.
At some point during this time, the AFA merges with CWA. What's the interaction like there? I mean, does that help? Does that have you been
Well,
able to?
yeah, we yeah, Rick had us go to like a luncheon with the AFA reps and talk about the CWA. And I remember telling them, I said, I love working here. I love having CWA as our representative. I talked about our research department. I said they bend over backwards for us. We got everything we needed to, you know, we had the support we needed. And they did decide to join us. And but that lasted a little while, and then of course, but it was just, it was the AFA, but then US Airways merged with American, and so the US Airways folks ended up in the other union with with American. I can't, what's their flight attendants union for American? They're not happy right now. They would rather be with AFA. Most of the flight attendants that are at US, well, that are American now, that used to be US Air.
What else do you want to tell us about your experience over the years in the union, dealing with the industry?
Well, I can say that arbitrations were very difficult. The company, if you had someone that got terminated and you feel like their, you know, their case was merited in arbitration, and it took a while. Like if you got terminated, you know, the company would drag their feet to do a first level hearing, second level hearing, third level. We had to go through the grievance steps. And then the last step would be to go to arbitration. You get a neutral arbitrator. The company has to be available on a certain date. The arbitrator, you know, we would say, I'm available tomorrow. Like I would tell the arbitrator, we're ready to go. the company say, oh, well, we got all these other cases. We only have one attorney dealing with the IAM. They would blow us off until 6, 8 months. So this person would be waiting to get their job back, and it would be over a year before we could even get an arbitration. So the airline was horrible about following through with arbitrations. And then we'd finally get the date, and we'd be a month out, and then they'd contact me and say, oh, we're going to offer them this little deal here. So in other words, it was like they waited till you were on the courthouse steps to try to make a deal. And that happened a lot. Like very seldom did we end up arbitrating. But contractual cases, we did win some really overtime, some really good overtime cases where the company was forcing mandatory overtime in the airports. And Nick Manicone was our attorney at the time in the very beginning. And he, you know, had a his background was in the transportation airline industry. So he was very instrumental in helping us win a bunch of our contract violation cases. But they took forever. I mean, like, you know, it was not a speedy process. And so people did get discouraged, and that was hard to keep people interested. You know, well, I don't even want to bother. I'm not going to file a grievance because it's never going to go anywhere. And I'll give you a tidbit about one of the mistakes like I made early on as an as doing, you know, approving arbitrations, right? I knew this person. I started working with her from the very beginning in 1985, and she was a good agent, but she messed up, and she got recorded saying something very damaging, I guess, or discriminatory on the phone. And she had no other violations, but they terminated her. And I decided I'm going to take this because I know her. She was a good employee, and I didn't have a great case. I think it was more emotional that I took it. So I learned my lesson as a new staff rep that you really have to have, you know, it has to be a really good case to win because your chances are 50-50 usually, especially when you have a neutral arbitrator. So, yeah, it was difficult. And a lot of times when you're doing a discipline case, it's just the staff rep facing off with a company attorney. But our advantage was that attorney knew nothing about what we did, didn't know the rules. So a lot of times we had a lot more knowledge than that attorney did when arguing the merits of the case and, you know, what we did as our job every day in the workplace. So.
You this sort of sparked another thought that I had, a question I want to ask. Talk about the impact that the internet has had on call center work in particular,
Oh,
in
yes.
the airline industry.
So at one point, we had over 5,000 reservation agents. And when it was all said and done with the internet and people doing their own reservations online, making changes online, we basically went down to about 1,500. In the end, there was about 1,500 reservation agents. And the other interesting thing was we had a frequent flyer call center that dealt with our frequent flyer issues. Like if you had points, you wanted to use them to book a ticket on another. So that office was in Winston-Salem, and there were over 150 people in there. And we wanted to, I forgot the term, we wanted to bring them into our contract. There's a term for that. I just forgot what it was. And the company said, they don't handle passengers. They're not passenger service. And I had to actually go to the NMB to argue this. And I said, look, I worked in reservations, and I would get a customer say to me, well, I'm going to book this, but I also want to talk to someone in the frequent flyer department about my points. And I would have to transfer them, and they would talk to this customer. So my example was, yes, they are passengers because I would transfer these people to that department. And so they ruled in favor of allowing these people to be brought into our contract. And it was the first time that had ever happened. So it was kind of historic. And they voted. I mean, we got them in, and they had the same contract, but then they'd have like a couple of sections, articles that were specific to them because they did something different than we did. But as far as the airport environment, definitely reduced the jobs. The biggest thing that reduced jobs in the airport were the kiosk machines. So, you know, when you walk in the airport, you just check in, you tag your own bag, the whole thing. That reduced a lot of our jobs in the airport environment. And when we were switching over systems, you know, like Y2K and all that was happening, we had a major failure with those systems, with those kiosks, and for 3 days people couldn't fly. We couldn't even get the planes out because we couldn't print tickets. We didn't have enough employees that could manually handle these people because the system had gone down, and we had lost multiple, like thousands and thousands of reservations were just gone in thin air. These people were showing up to go to a funeral or go to a wedding and whatever. We had no record of them. We had nothing. And I can remember going to one of the labor meetings, and I was very emotional. I had typed up this long. I said, people were, my members were being taken out of the airport on stretchers because they were being verbally assaulted and, you know, screamed at all day long, 3 days straight. People were lined up down the sidewalk at the airports trying to get someone to help them. And I said, we need more employees. We are short-staffed. And it's funny, one of the board of director members, I remember his name, Herbert Baum. He used to be the CEO of Dial Corporation. He used to always sit next to me in these meetings, and he seemed like so interested in the job, you know, what we did and what I was bringing to the meetings. And he said, I agree, Val, but I really think, because I fly all the time and it seems like I'm always standing in a long line because you don't have enough employees. And after that meeting, Parker agreed, and they said, we're going to hire 1,000 more airport workers. And so that was also, I felt like just so excited that I could help relieve the stress at the airports. 1,000 probably wasn't enough even, but still, we were just excited to hear they were going to finally hire more people. So that was very, very helpful. You know, we went through two more mergers. We went through America West and what they tried to do to us there. America West had, they were in the process of organizing with the Teamsters, and they were making top pay of $13 an hour, and we were making like $21 an hour. And we didn't know for sure what they were doing, but the company came to us and said, we need to take another concession. Like, they came to us three times. We went through three different concessionary givebacks while the company was struggling. And one of the proposals they threw on the table was our top pay was going to go from 21 down to $13 an hour. And we were like, there is no way these people are going to agree to this. It's not happening. So what Rick decided to do, and Larry Cohen was president then too, was we were going to do a strike vote if they were going to try to force this on us. And I'll never forget this. They had hired some million-dollar union buster firm to come in and get us to give all this stuff up. And we'd be in these meetings, and this was in Crystal City, Virginia, right in DC. We're in this room with no windows. It's very foreboding, you know. And we go in there with this box of all the ballots that were returned. We had 80 something percent of the people vote to strike, and we put them in a box. And we walked into that bargaining room, and when Rick tipped that box up on top of the desk and dumped them all out, and he said, we are not taking that pay cut. 80 something percent of our members are not in agreement, and they will strike. If we give them authorization, they're going to strike. And it worked. But I will say, the drama that came out of this guy, he stood up. He had this, the bankruptcy notebook, which was this big with all these rules in it. And I'll never forget what he said. This was comical in a way. We all kind of giggled, but he took the book and very violently slammed it on the desk, and he said, the blood of your members will be on your hands. And we all just thought, this guy's lost his mind, you know? So I'll never forget that ever. So, anyways, so we succeeded in not taking that pay cut, but we did agree to $17 an hour, which was less than we were making before we had a union. And that to me was a huge, huge slap. I mean, all the work and all the years we worked to get from $17.88 an hour top pay to $21, $22, you know, and then we dropped back to $17. But that was also part of snapback. We did snapback. And the agents are currently topped out at like $32 an hour now
Wow,
with the last
that's great.
contract. I mean, I started at $4.50 an hour doing that job. And now those folks
What year was
32 and
it that you just described?
it's on that sheet I sent you, and I can't,
Oh,
I
okay.
just can't
I'll look
memorize it.
for
But yeah, it's on the history sheet in there, and I'm trying to remember what year that was. 2005, 2004, in that
Yeah,
period, I think.
2004 looks like.
2004, I think it was. Yeah,
Yeah.
because that was right before we merged with America West.
Which was 2005.
And the interesting thing about merging with America, 2004, 2005. Yeah, it was 2005
Yeah.
because I have it. I don't have it printed, but I was just trying to see where it was in here. But so the interesting thing, I don't know if you want me to talk at all about forming the association with the Teamsters. That was an interesting process. That was one of, I don't know who came up with it, probably Rick, Larry, I don't know. The Teamsters, so when we were merging with America West, the Teamsters had just had a successful campaign organizing customer service, passenger service at America West. They were much smaller than us, though. And what, the next step in a merger is if there's two different unions representing the same class and craft in the two airlines, you're forced into a runoff election. So we weren't sure that this would, that it would stick because we had people that were, you know, upset about the pay concessions we had to take and the different things that had happened over the last few years after 9/11. That I don't know if there was that confidence that we would continue to maintain our representation if we had this election. So the CWA and the IBT got together and decided let's create an association. And the company did not want to recognize it. They were like, no way, you're not doing this, because they knew it. They knew they wouldn't be, we wouldn't be forced into a an election, and that was their chance to get rid of the union in passenger service. So the decision was we would split the country down the Mississippi River. They would have all of the West Coast and we would have the East Coast. And it was very, a lot of planning, a lot of meetings, a lot of trying to figure out who is in charge, when are they in charge. So we formed this association, and the members did have to vote for that. They did have to put a vote out on it. And it was successful. So we were able to continue with that. And then we had to sit down with the Teamsters and figure out, okay, we already have a contract, but these folks here at America West, maybe they don't like everything we have, or maybe there's some bonus or benefit they have that they wanted to add. So we had to sit down and negotiate to incorporate them into our contract, but also try to include things that they would like to see added. And they had some different rules as their scheduling rules and their way they did their shift trades and things like that and their holidays. So then we had to intricate, we had to then put our seniority together. And I know that America West wanted us, they wanted 2 years for their every one because they were a more junior company. And we said, we're never going to do that. But that was a proposal they wanted. The Teamsters said, no, they want 2 years. And the company wasn't going to give them the 2 years for everyone because that meant they'd all get a pay raise, right? I mean, their pay raises were merit, and ours were, we were on a pay scale, you know, an 11-year pay scale, and we topped out. And they could, you could be sitting next to someone with 10 years and they could be making less money than you at America West, and I might have been there 5 years. It just depends on if your supervisor liked you or not, or your manager. So they, some of them were like, well, I'm a good employee and I always get a raise. I don't need a pay scale. And some people just don't need, deserve that raise. And so, but we were successful in convincing them they needed to be on a pay scale. So, and they got, a lot of them got huge raises immediately. Like they were making $13 top of pay, top scale. And a lot of them jumped to $17, you know. So, but it was, there was so much that, you know, intricate rules that we had to work out. And then we had another merger. Well, we almost merged with United. You know that, right?
I do know that,
Remember that? Or was it Delta? It was Delta, I think it
No, it was
was. If I remember.
United. It was
It was
United.
United. Okay, all right. And that was not successful. They did not want to merge with us. And Doug Parker, and it, you know what happened during that merger was the company kind of was looking the other way. They weren't paying attention to running US Air, US Airways. They were more concerned. All their efforts were being put into this merger. In the meantime, we're flailing over here. And we had a financial issue again. You know, we had, that was, I think, our third concession that we had to go through. It was amazing. It was like a roller coaster ride every other year. It was just crazy. And so, and I know, I don't know if you guys knew this, is a little just trivia, but Doug Parker, when he found out that day that the merger was not going through, it didn't get approved, he went out and got a DUI and got put in jail. It was, and do you know how many of the unions tried to use it against him? Like, oh, and you still got your job, but if it was one of us getting fired in our job, we would have been like, oh, you know, that was, oh, we heard that all the time. You know, oh, Doug went to jail for a DUI, and you know, so yeah, it was crazy.
Quite a career.
Yes, definitely.
Debbie, do you have some questions? Anything you want to?
I was intrigued by something you said. So there was a merger with American Airlines, which I'd
Yes.
like you to talk about because, as I recall, negotiating that contract and particularly dealing with the stay-at-home agents was a big issue and a big success.
It was huge. And you know, in the past, I don't know what's that. I'm sorry, go ahead.
You finish it, and then I have another question.
Okay, so we had tried in previous years, the CWA tried to organize American Airlines. We had two or three elections, they were not successful. American was tough. They ran some tough anti-union campaigns. They spent millions and millions of dollars so that their customer service would not vote in the union. This is interesting. So when we merged with American, they really needed the approval for this merger to go through. And so they asked not just, you know, our union, but they asked every union to go and lobby. And we had over 300 appointments, and we went to DC and we were put into groups. So we had a pilot, flight attendant, mechanic, customer service, and then a company manager person split up into these huge groups. We had over, I don't know how many people showed up. It was very well organized, but we went and visited all the representatives and asked them to please vote to allow this union to go through because a lot of people might be out of jobs if it doesn't happen. And so that merger did go through only because of the help of the agents and the employees. We went and fought for this merger. And we asked the company to not run an anti-union campaign and give us the ability to organize the American Airlines agents without any pushback. And they did agree to that. And they held to that. They did not run an anti-union campaign. And so we were allowed, I was allowed, I spent 9 months in the Miami airport organizing Miami folks because that was one of our largest locations. And they let me go through security. They let me go sit in the break rooms and talk to the employees. I was shocked. But that was the type of relationship we had developed with the company at that point because they were appreciative that we helped get this union, this merger, you know, accomplished. So that was not so difficult, but then there was, you know, definitely hiccups with trying to get them organized. And then when you talked about the call, the work at home group, they were a tough group to organize because many of them worked from home. And how do we get access to them? We had to go door to door. Raleigh had a big work at home group. I think there was one up in Connecticut. And Miami, I think, had one. So we had to go find out where these people were and go knock on their door and talk to them about the union. And many of them were like, oh no, you know, they didn't give them health care coverage. They were treated almost like a contractor. And we had to show them, look, they were on a completely different pay scale. They didn't get the same holidays, vacation. They had a much lesser pay and benefit package than the people that worked in the call centers and at the airports. And you know, we were telling them, look, you'll have a voice at the table. You'll be able to negotiate what you want. So we did convince them. They did not, the majority of them didn't vote for the union, but we had enough where we won the election. And we were able to negotiate. It was a tough fight with the company, but we got them pretty much almost the same pay and all the same benefits. And we said the company had to pay for their internet, their separate internet. The company had to pay for all their equipment. So there was a lot of things that saved them a ton of money. And but then over the years, they realized that for some reason, the productivity wasn't as good when people were working at home. So they started pulling them all in. They were going to get rid of it. And then COVID hit. And now most of our call folks are at home. They've shut down the Winston-Salem office. It's no longer operating. People are working out of their houses. Yeah, they just completely emptied the building out a couple weeks ago. It's gone now. It's not even, they used to have some management people in there to do training. Now they're not even, they're going to work out of their houses. So all their training is going to be like online. What a change, right?
Mm-hmm. And how, do
but
you
they're have still any... making the same benefits and, you know, so they're still making the $32 an hour top pay.
Do you have any advice of how you keep a strong union when it's work at home call center workers?
That's difficult. I mean, communication, a newsletter, sending out, you know, like emails and updating people, doing some Zoom calls would be helpful so that they can connect with other people, because you're in your home all day without, you don't know what's going on out there. So I think those are very helpful. Conference calls, Zoom calls, and I think newsletters, that type of thing would be your best bet. Because you really can't go door to door and visit these people. It's just too hard.
I have one other question. In the information you sent us, you said, I served on the Labor Management Committee at American Airlines. All the unions sent a rep every other month to meet with Doug Parker, CEO, and the board of directors. CWA convinced the company to set this up after they wanted the board of directors seats back from the unions. These meetings were very effective in fixing many issues. Talk a little bit about this.
Well, we had, during the bankruptcy, in return for concessions, the CWA said, we would like some seats, you know, we want a seat on the board. And so they went back and forth about it. But I think we got three seats, the pilots, flight attendants, and our group got a seat on the board. So we appointed this woman to serve for us. Well, then with the merger with American, they needed those seats back. They needed those board of director seats back, and they wanted to eliminate them. And so the CWA said, and I know we initiated this, the CWA said, look, we'll give these seats up, the seat up, but we want to have interaction. You need to hear from the frontline people on a regular basis. And we want these meetings. And we would say, you know, each union group got to send one person to go to these meetings every 2 months. And in these meetings, we weren't allowed to talk about grievances, but we were allowed to talk about operational problems, problems with human resources, which was always, always an issue at the airline. Hiring, you know, staffing issues. One time I brought up an issue in Miami that was, you know, I had already tried to meet with the director of the airport and she wasn't willing to work with us on it. So I brought it, you know, I always made sure I tried to fix it first before I'd go to them and bring them this issue. And I would survey all my local presidents, the seven local presidents I had every month. And I'd say, send me your biggest issues that are not grievances that you want me to bring to these meetings. And I would have a list and I print up a list for them as well. And I would go in there with these major problems, and I'd always start out with my first thing is I would thank them for any of the things they resolved from the last meeting and report on how well those were working for the members. And it really helps the morale if, you know, they recognize that you're fixing these problems. For example, the no fly list was very important to people, and that was accomplished through these meetings. The hiring of the 1,000 extra agents, that was accomplished in these meetings. But I invited the other local leaders, the union leaders, to meet. Let's meet the night before and let's see what common issues we have. So we just voice it as one group. HR was always the biggest problem. Like you'd file a complaint with HR about a manager or something was happening and they just would, you know, would be a rubber stamp. They would just send us this form letter and it was always, well, we did the investigation and we didn't find anything. And we got tired of it. It wasn't just our group. It was going on with all the groups. And so we said to the company, we said, we need something done about this because it's ineffective to even go to HR. We don't even bother anymore because it's just ineffective. So we were able to, it wasn't perfect, but we were able to convince Doug Parker and the board that we needed, you know, We needed some relief in HR when we had problems. We had managers that would show up drunk at the airports, and they didn't care. And I brought that to him one day about this one manager who was, harassing the agents, come back from his lunch break and he was tipsy and falling over himself. And they'd let him know when they were coming so he would not be drunk. So we finally said, I said to Doug, I go, you need to send someone and not tell him you're coming and you'll see this guy. And they did. They showed up. He was drunk. They escorted him off the property. And the agents were like, okay, this is effective. We see that the union is doing these type of things. It isn't necessarily a grievance, right? But it was an HR issue. So that was some of the things that I really enjoyed about being involved in that was I could get right to the people who needed to make these effective changes. So
So, Velvet, any last thoughts?
I think that I see the unions are starting to gain some ground, in organizing, and that's very encouraging. I mean, I retired in 2017, but I still keep up to date on everything. And we had the nurses here in our local hospital just organized a couple of years ago. They're having trouble getting a contract too, and so I've done a few like informational pickets with them. I still try to stay involved legislatively. I go out and try to knock on doors when we're having elections to get people to vote. So it really influenced me. It was a huge benefit, and it influenced my daughter. I mean, she's 32 now, and she is such a pro-union person. She joined the union at her school in California. She's a social worker and therapist, and she called me up and she goes, "Mom, I'm a member of the union now." She's very excited. So, yeah, she's always supported me in
Well,
what I did.
thank you for all you've done for our union and for the cause. This has been terrific. I can't thank you enough for spending these 2 hours with us. It's been eye-opening for me. I mean, a real insight into the industry that you've talked about. But it's been fun as well. So thank you for doing it, Velvet.
Yes. Well, I enjoyed it. Thank you for asking me. I really enjoyed it. It's like it doesn't seem like all of that could have happened in that amount of time, right? 17 years that I was a staff rep. I was staff for 17 years, and and I also worked in mobility for my last couple of years. I did mobility, which also I found very fascinating. It was a completely different industry, and I had to learn all the lingo and everything else, but I enjoyed that too.
Cool.